Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me as always is Steve. How are you doing?
Hey, John. I'm well. Great to be here. How are you?
Good. Just crying in my coffee over Ethereum going down. It should only go up, really.
I think that's a bit unrealistic, John, right? I mean, I cried when my Doge went down and then went up and then went down. But if you cry so much, then there's just no point in this. Just ride the wave, buy the dip.
Save your tears. But I should be happy this week because we have a great guest joining us from almost exactly a year ago. And so much has happened in 2021. We have plenty to talk about. He had lots of great insight last time. We have Charles Dellingpole, the founder and CEO at Comply Advantage. Welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here, Steve.
Well, I guess tell us what you think was some of the most eventful things in 2021. We'll just jump right into it.
I guess within fintech, everything was super exciting. I think you saw roughly 10% of national GDP transferred by fintech firms in loan relief programs. You saw GameStop, you saw NFTs, you saw Dogecoin. And within our space, you saw this explosion of fraud, money laundering, terrorist financing. Crypto came to be seen as a huge vehicle for money laundering. I think the only constant is change within fintech, which is why the fintech news podcast is so prolific and now rivaling Joe Rogan.
yes, right. And with the great listenership comes great responsibility. Sure. You mentioned before how Comply Advantage is really tackling money laundering. And we talked about PPP and some of the issues with that last year. What were the unique challenges or interesting criminal kind of activity that you saw in 2021?
We had a great year in terms of the kind of growth of the team and the client base and the search volume. So we work with thousands of companies all over the world, a huge number in the US, Asia, Europe, elsewhere, across lending, fintech, crypto. We have kind of 200 companies that embed our database of terrorists, money launderers, criminals. We had an amazing year. We invested very heavily in the product. We're now 350 people. We signed up hundreds of new clients on our startup program. So I think some people think it's 2021, fintech's reaching a late stage, but we had 150 companies sign up to our startup program. So there are still tons of companies being created. I personally invested in about 80 fintech companies this year across blockchain, crypto, lending in Africa, in Brazil, everywhere. I think from a Comply Watch perspective, we're still seeing huge amounts of change. All the kind of companies that we have are growing very, very quickly. And I think it's really, fintech is now reaching this kind of stage where a lot of the companies are maturing very rapidly, becoming much more mainstream, a lot less risk, because the incumbent finance companies haven't reacted, haven't invested, or unable to invest or react because they have this very mature client base, this very old school architecture, and the fintechs are really running rings around them.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've heard somewhere that essentially, I believe it's either $1 in $4 or $1 in $3 from VC goes into fintech now, which just shows the extent of the industry and how much it's growing. But also one other thing that we've seen is that a lot of companies are now going public. And I know that, you know, you've reached a certain scale now, you have customers throughout the globe. Is there any plan for your company to go public maybe next year or the year after that? Or is that not on your roadmap now?
We've raised $110 million from Index Ventures, Bolton, as well as companies like Goldman Sachs, Ontario Teachers Pension Plan. And typically the reason why you go public is as an acquisition currency, because existing investors want liquidity. And I think in terms of those drivers, we don't have those because, for instance, Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, they would be a shareholder post-IPO as well as pre-IPO. And at least in terms of the VC investment we have, we were kind of quite early on in those funds. And we raised our first Series A back in 2016. So it's been 5 years since then. So really, we have a lot of time before then. And I think early on, I think when you're growing, it's often a case of the numbers are quite small. So we're now roughly at $40 million of ARR, and that's basically doubled this year. So if you put that on a kind of 20 times multiple, we created hundreds of millions of dollars of value this year for our investors. And ideally, we double again next year, right? So really, if we can create $1 billion of value every single year, then they want to hold on to that value. And then in terms of pressure to be able to raise money, often you get these late stage growth funds that can put in $100 million, $200 million without really blinking. So I think there's no pressure to IPO. And really, what we like to do is just ramp up investment. So we have 250 people working on tech, engineering, product, but really there's tons of stuff that we'd love to be doing as well in parallel. So I think for us, it's all about creating the very best product in the world for risk, compliance, AML, transaction monitoring, and scaling that up rather than this kind of shareholder cap table issue of an IPO. Like, it's not as if you're going to sell out at IPO, and it's not as if you're going to somehow all the problems you had are going to go away. If anything, there's simply more problems because you're doing it all in the public eye, and any kind of issue is just magnified. And suddenly, you know, like in the Financial Times comment section or in the Wall Street Times comment section, you know, there's kind of all kinds of complaints or theories, or, you know, I think just doing it out of the public eye is just far more convenient and enjoyable, right? So I think at some point you want an IPO, but I don't think it's going to be particularly fun, right? I think doing it in private where you can just get on with things, and, you know, I think you have a board that's actually adding value rather than is there as a kind of token to reassure public investors. I think I think going public means you need to be predictable, means you need to have
a huge compliance investor relations and all of the kind of bureaucracy grows up around that.
I think if you don't hit budget and you're public, then you're screwed, right? And no one will trust you ever again. Whereas I think when you have VCs on the board, they're heavily involved. They understand the company. They get involved. Whereas I think NEDs on listed boards, you know, I just kind of worry about the quality and conviction of the people doing it. And having to communicate with hundreds of shareholders, that, you know, I think that's going to be a challenge, right?
It's a challenge for the companies that are public, yeah.
I think at some point we'll do it, but I think it's not something that's going to help the business in the short term.
Yeah. So what are you seeing developing in fintech land? Actually, specifically in London and the UK. Any other post Brexit kind of effects filtering through?
So I think the specific way in which Brexit was done in the UK was that there was no equivalence with e-regulation, and therefore the government has complete latitude to implement policy and design regulation as it chooses. In terms of how we've actually exploited that, or actually how we've engineered changes to be more amenable to growth or competition, I think what you have seen is minor changes to the listing regime, such that it's more favorable towards dual class shareholder structures. You've seen some changes with regards to the size of listings, but in reality, you've seen elsewhere things like the Competition Commission, the CMA, block certain mergers or acquisitions that were meant to be done, and therefore what you haven't seen is this kind of wholesale shift towards growth and trying to attract every business globally as possible. So in reality, the real change has been there hasn't been a huge change in policy, even though they have complete latitude to do so.
Oh, so keeping on the same track for right now, how about in the US? Any trends you're noticing here on the fintech side?
I think particularly within crypto, what you saw under the jurisdiction of Brian Brooks when he was head of the OCC up until when Trump left power in kind of February was the interpretation of national legislation as being extremely favorable to crypto. So you had Anchorage, for instance, being issued with a national bank charter. You saw 10,000 community banks, so the capability of offering crypto as being like some sort of deposit solution via stablecoins. I think now you've seen the wholesale reassessment of that. So I think this these kind of structural regulatory drivers which enable adoption, you've seen lots of pushback from the incumbent banks who fear there's some sort of asymmetric regulation, given that the government under Yellen doesn't want crypto to become the equivalent of Swiss unhosted bank accounts, particularly with regards to unhosted wallets. This kind of wholesale adoption of crypto across the board is being slowed down. But then on the other hand, you see this countervailing force of companies like Coinbase, which are doing $5 billion in revenue and roughly $1 billion, $2 billion in profit, right? So these companies are pumping off cash. They have all kinds of money to invest. And you've seen the kind of incremental maturation of the underlying technology such that you have things like NFTs. I'm not sure to what extent you guys own things like Bored Apes or all these new, like everyone was always excited about the capabilities of smart contracts. And now actually you see them going into the mainstream, right? So I think tons of innovation around crypto. But then aside from that, all the other fintechs are still growing very quickly. And the underlying benefits of the architecture that they have means that they can run rings around the incumbents.
All right, I've got one more for you. DAO. These are basically decentralized organizations, as the name implies, and it strikes me as basically a nightmare for the AML KYC space. So is there any overlap between Comply Advantage and what you guys can do in DAOs and the rise of DAOs?
DAOs. I think that the most well-known iteration of a DAO was Constitution DAO, which was outbid by Ken Griffin, given that he knew precisely what the maximum bid was. So that was hilarious, right? At least I found it pretty funny. particularly how much the internet hates Ken Griffin, right? So I think speaking within Comply Advantage and what we do, there are various types of things which are vehicles for laundering money. So you've probably seen Die Hard, right? And you've seen Hans Gruber.
Every Christmas.
It's a classic Christmas film, movie, yeah. Obviously. It's the most well-known Christmas film because they all have office parties and it's all Christmassy. But basically, the whole reason behind Hans Gruber raiding the Nakatomi Plaza building in that tragedy was to get to the bearer bonds in the basement. And similarly, you have bearer companies and you have companies owned by themselves. You have offshore shell companies. And a DAO is a kind of headless, acephalous entity with no particular owner that somehow is a conduit for funds. And so in many respects, is this kind of new form of a shell company that you don't really know who actually owns it. And that can change in seconds. So from a money laundering perspective, a DAO is like a nightmare because you have all this money going in and all this money being exfiltrated in seconds. So then to have something like a constitution owned by an autonomous community, like something so permanent and durable and eternal, owned by something so ephemeral, that it's a kind of structural oxymoron, I think. I think from a money laundering perspective, it's quite problematic.
Speaking of problematic, this year we saw the release of the Pandora Papers, which essentially showed how a lot of wealthy individual people in the world are hiding their assets away from the tax man. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think in terms of like the range of issues with regards to shell companies and secret bank accounts, private jets, yachts, all owned by offshore entities. I think what we had in January in the US was this AML Act 2021, which basically stipulated that FinCEN will now be funded to have a central repository of ultimate beneficial owners. What you have in the US, in EU, is the opposite, which is a range of registries which are open. So I think if anything, the solution to those and the different entities exposed in Pandora Papers is going to be more transparency. But the route which the US has chosen, which is particularly onerous for small companies and Main Street, will make it much more difficult.
How is it onerous for small companies?
So basically, rather than simply submitting it to your local state registry, who you are ultimately owned by, as you see in Europe, what will happen is that they have to file to FinZen, who they're owned by, and keep it up to date. So it's basically an additional process, an additional piece of work they have to do.
Okay, so a separate piece of reporting.
Exactly, yeah. So I think it's the same issue, though, in terms of what we have in the Pandora Papers is lots of different offshore providers who have leaked all different records and companies and linked to lots of different political exposed entities. So what ClimateMarches does is we have a database of every politically exposed entity in the whole world, and we're mapping that to those companies and those shareholdings. So this kind of precisely plays into what we do. So what we'd like to have is more open data that we can link into our core knowledge graph and find insights and connections and risks. But because it's closed within FinCEN, it's much harder to get to.
Okay, so this new law where people have to, not expose, but report the beneficial owner is not the open, transparent thing that we think of when we think of disclosure. It's more reporting to, it's kind of, the government will have the information, but the public and maybe other interested parties won't necessarily have access or know what those relationships or ownerships are.
All these institutions, like every single company in the US, has to now report to FinCEN their ultimate beneficial owner. That's onerous for mainstream because it means there's a whole new range of work to be done for them.
It was really interesting how the Pandora Papers kind of got exposed. I had no idea there's these coalition of journalists from around the world working together on this. I didn't know that happened. There was coordinated reporting.
This is a kind of third set of leaks they dealt with, like fourth arguably. So they've done previously Panama Papers, Paradise Papers, and the FinCEN files. So all of those have kind of similar dynamics in terms of they've taken files that were previously private and made them public and worked with The Guardian and The Wall Street Journal, New York Times to analyze those and figure out which people are highly prominent and which are laundering or hiding assets.
Yeah, it certainly points to the prevalence of these actions, right? One thing that also has one trend that I've noticed as well is that as we have, of course, have dealt with the pandemic, a lot of the art market has shifted from in person, where I understand that houses like Christie and Sotheby's may sometimes do a light KYC, to now being completely online. And I'm wondering, what is your perspective on the art market, which is famously, of course, not transparent? It's difficult to understand who's buying what and why they're paying that price. And what are the implications for your company with the art market in regards to AML?
Earlier on, the kind of diehard example talks about bearer shares and bearer bonds, right? So the ownership of the company changes with the owner of the shares. Or similarly, the owner of the debt, the bearer bonds, changes with the whoever has possession. And I think the ultimate bearer asset, as in ownership changes, is art, because possession is 9/10 of the law. And I think particularly with NFTs, what you've seen is wash trading. So to inflate the value of an asset, what you'll do is simply pretend as a transaction. So often on OpenSea, assets trade hands, but the actual underlying value is highly dubious because it's simply a JPEG, right? Or it's not actually a JPEG, it's an entry on a blockchain, right? So, at least with NFTs, what you have is programmatically a commission of, say, 10% being transferred back to the issuer of the NFT in terms of the actual artist. With art, obviously, that doesn't happen. So the wash trading dynamic means that difficult to value assets can be used as a cover for money laundering because there's this huge transfer of wealth. In theory, it's a consideration for the transfer of an entry on a blockchain, which proves provenance and ownership of an asset. But actually, that asset could be transferred between related parties, and therefore the transaction could be a scam. You know, people say, is crypto a Ponzi scheme? And I think it gets to the very core dynamics of what makes art or culture valuable. I think that there's an innate human desire to look at artifacts or relics, you know, like things taken from foreign lands, or and so I think having a rational economic explanation of the value of art is quite challenging, and it made only more challenging by the different social dynamics present online as well. So yeah, I think that's a great essay question that you can go on and interrogate for hours.
We should note for our listeners also that wash trading is essentially the practice of selling an item for $10, using a different wallet or account to buy it from yourself, basically, for, say, $15, and then using that price differential to create demand in the market, and also the impression that there's demand for this asset, so that ultimately whoever buys the asset, who's not the wash trader, ends up holding the bag.
Firstly, I think this wash trading dynamic means that it's very easy to fake the transfer of value, particularly, and also that if value derives from precedent transactions and those are amongst related parties, then clearly the value is a sham, and there isn't a kind of true third party proving that value. So yeah, it's a great vehicle for laundering money and a great vehicle for fraud, because people don't actually know what the value of something is.
All right, leaving the world of NFT and Bitcoin trading and all those other things that we've discussed, going back to the product and your company as well. You recently announced a partnership with a company called Raisin, a German neobank. And we've also noticed that a lot of your customers on your website tend to be sort of the newer players. Is your strategy to essentially go after the newer entrants into the space, or do you still plan on working with larger, more established institutions that also have that AML KYC compliance need?
I think what we have is the very best solution for helping companies determine if a personal company is high risk. So if, say, you're linked to Jeffrey Epstein or sex traffickers or money launderers, then we have the best system for that. And that's what's powering a lot of our growth. So a lot of our competitors, they do it. They have a team of 400 researchers who manually compile a database. We built it via algorithms, and therefore it's far superior and getting more superior as time goes on. So I think that solution is applicable to every company in the whole world, whether it's finance, whether it's looking at a supply chain, whether it's looking at identity. I think we have tons of companies who also resell data. So a lot of companies who offer this solution are actually embedding our data within their platform. And so really, we're just investing more and more people and innovation in expanding the breadth, depth, and sophistication of this platform. So in terms of where the growth is coming from, it's every industry, every vertical, every country, and it's only the beginning.
There also seems to be a lot of emphasis recently, both from an enforcement and a policy perspective, on things like AML, KYC, tax evasion, tax avoidance. And this all points to, you know, essentially tailwinds for a compliant advantage, right?
Yeah, I think, and also everything else has failed to solve the problem, right? I think every year banks are being fined billions of dollars. They have huge compliance teams, and you have things like tax evasion. And so what we're producing will make a huge dent in that and make it far harder for companies to avoid justice.
Yeah, it makes you feel like you're just scratching the surface. There's certainly no shortage or no lack of growth opportunity for you guys.
I mean, we've kind of doubled investment this year in our tech team. We're now 350 people. We're spending $50 million a year.
What were you at the start of the year? How many people?
So I think we've hired the best part of 120 or something. So, but then a lot of them are a lot of the people are kind of like not like for like. So a graduate on $50,000 versus a senior exec on $400,000. I think a lot of the addition we've made, the reason why our costs have doubled in tech this year is because we've added kind of world-leading experts on machine learning, on knowledge graphs, on AI, on scalability. And we've seen clients like Visa, Affirm, eToro, all kind of join this year. So I think a huge step change across the board.
Yeah, great, great. How much does the requirement to have explainable AI, you mentioned all these processes, and I imagine there's so many steps involved it gets to be difficult to track exactly why some result is coming up or what the connection is. And I wouldn't laugh for the six examples, Steve, because you would be going down with me, by the way.
I would be.
Yeah. So how does and increasingly regulators they've been concerned about having a black box versus being able to explain the reason why you're getting a certain result and in more and more detail. How does that impact what you're doing?
So we're looking at two things, customer risk and entity risk. So then also opposite side of that, which is transactional risk. So on the customer risk side, it's kind of, you can see there's a page and you can see that as part of that in, say, Russian, there's a guy called John linked to Vladimir Putin, right? The challenge is being able to connect that connection to a company in the Alaska corporate registry, linking that to a kind of fraud in Botswana, and taking in every single fact and linking it all together. So I think once you see it and once you have the provenance of the data and the facts explained, it's very, very obvious, intuitive and explicable. I think where it's less intuitive and needs more explanatory power is on transaction risk. So I think there what you'll do is say, like, we have hundreds of millions of transactions being analyzed by our system looking for fraud, money laundering, terrorist financing. And that's based upon suspicious patterns of behavior. And often there it's a case of giving it precedence where it is high risk and it is a true positive, and then doing feature extraction to demonstrate, okay, in 9 out of 10 cases where you have this typology, that's indicative of a Russian sex trafficking scheme. Once you have its typologies embedded in the system, then it's clear. So I think it's much harder within transaction risk to explain the risks than it is within customer risk.
Huh. Interesting. So what do you see ahead for in 2022 for Comply Advantage and money laundering?
So I think a really exciting
not that
thing,
those two are the same thing, but
yeah, exactly. I think one exciting thing for the US is the Enablers Act. So I think for a long time, the US government has allowed lawyers, bankers, accountants, and other service providers a free rein whereby there's no liability for them and they don't have to check their clients because of client attorney privilege or whatever the euphemism for that is. I think that could be changed in 2022, and that will lead to a real crackdown on money laundering and financial crime. I think for my advantage, I think we're going to invest on the basis of the success we've had this year extremely heavily in next year. I think we have $50 million of cash still, and we're going to spend it on hiring great people and acquiring more clients and growing and solving the underlying problem of terrorist financing, money laundering. So yeah, I think the job isn't done yet, even though we're kind of 7 years in. I think there's still huge potential.
Yeah, I think we saw that in 2021. The world keeps throwing out more and more challenges at us. Our challenge for 2022 is to have you back and to ask you tougher questions. You're so knowledgeable and informative on so many topics. It feels like we can throw anything at you. So
pressure makes diamonds, right? If I have softball questions, then I won't learn anything. But I think put me under pressure and I'll be a better person because of it, right?
Yeah, sure. All of us, yeah. By that measure, I guess I should be a genius by now, but not happening. I think there's a lot of raw talent with you, Charlie. So we see that coming out. So So yeah, we'll definitely have to have you back in 2022, and we'll be ready for you. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in 2022? I keep thinking things will calm down since I think 2011 or so, but it seems
the future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed in pockets, right? So I think there are certain pockets where you can see the future, and I think those same structural forces and trends that we saw this year will only become stronger. So I think, like, looking ahead, you know, you might see, say, simultaneous invasion of Taiwan and Ukraine, right? You might see a lot more big banks struggling under competition from this morass of fintechs. I think, but I think that the one bet is that technology is a very powerful force that's only becoming stronger.
Oof, and that's nothing to say of more climate volatility, another deadlier variant of some virus. The world's getting
it's all looking up. Yeah.
Well, we have to look at you don't need to prepare for all the good case scenarios. You just have to prepare for the bad things, I guess.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Like I said, very, very informative, as usual. And we'd love to have you back in 2022.
Absolutely.
Three-time champion.
You might have a Spotify-only podcast alongside Joe Rogan, but let's see, right? Hopefully, your listeners come with you.
We'll see if you make the cut next year.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay. That's Charles Dellingpole, the founder and CEO of Comply Advantage. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening. We'll be right back.